We talk about homicide and we talk about domestic violence, but usually we talk about them as though they're two separate problems. That is often not the case. It can and does happen that domestic violence culminates in a homicide. That's what happened to a woman named Tabitha Birdsong, whose family calls her death at the hands of an abusive partner slow motion murder. Tabitha's story is part of what inspired Jackson County prosecutor Jean Peters Baker to pursue a new initiative she's just announced for Kansas City, a program she hopes will lead to intervention in domestic violence before a homicide occurs. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've invited Jean Peters Baker on our show to talk about what the initiative is and how it's supposed to work. Jean Peters Baker, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's back up a second. I just mentioned Tabitha Birdsong. I know her case is pending and you're limited in what you can say, but talk to me to the extent you can about her story and what it made clear to you.
So I am guided by, principles of ethics in the judicial system not to speak about her case after the filing of a complaint, which has happened in this case. And that is because I want to assure that I can get justice for Tabitha through that prosecution. So I won't speak about her case directly. However, her case is not unlike others. And so I will talk about the type of case that, you know, sort of is represented in some of those facts. And I think it is not uncommon to find victims of domestic violence that are that work really, really hard at trying to use the system to protect themselves and to protect their children and to live safely. And too often that system fails them.
In what ways are you able to observe a system failing them, a system that you are part of?
Yes, I I'm on a different floor of the courthouse now in the current position that I have. But in the many years that I've worked in the prosecuting attorney's office, one of those times I worked in the domestic violence unit. And literally across the hall from my office is where women would go to court for that order of protection. And, you would see the desperation in those women and the vulnerability in them. And I do want to sort of just back up a moment that I'm going to use pronouns as they are commonly used in the domestic violence realm. So she is almost almost always the victim, not always though. He is almost always the perpetrator, but not always. So those pronouns can switch. And my office, of course, carries cases, you know, where the pronouns are flip-flopped as well. So I want that to be known, that we are not, there's not a particular victim that...
You're not making an assumption. You're making, you're using what you see being the most common scenario.
True. So, victims are most commonly women, just not always. And offenders are most commonly men, but not always in this realm. So what I see is the vulnerability of victims and how the system, as it is required to be used, places even more vulnerability on that victim. She has to confront, by terms of the Constitution, her offender, the accused. And that is eyeball to eyeball. And when you are a domestic violence victim, that's a terrifying prospect.
When you think about Kansas City's homicide problem, how much of that is rooted in domestic violence?
It's hard to say exactly because I don't think those numbers are, so closely monitored so that when a case is domestic violence homicide versus, it falls into some other category. But... certainly, these are cases that I see with regularity and cases that I file. They are cases that are often solved. So the solvability rate on domestic violence homicides is high, as we would expect.
As in you're able to figure out who did it.
We are able to figure out who did it. The whodunit is usually not there. It is often it's a review of this person's life and how we failed them along the way.
So We'll get back into some of those systemic failures as you see them, but I am curious, exactly what is this new initiative and how will it work?
So this initiative is really, it's about a collaboration and a partnership among not just prosecutors, of course, and police, which are critical partners, but our domestic violence community, you know, shelters, advocates, all of those other partners that support victims along the way. And I am really excited when I get to broaden my coalition. This community in Kansas City is and in Jackson County is very, very strong.
This community, what do you mean?
Community of advocates, those who are well-educated about some of the root causes of domestic violence, some of the triggers of domestic violence. I believe we have some of the best in the country that live and work right here in Jackson County. And too often, we do not call them to our table and ask them to be high-level collaborators with us in figuring out how to carry out a prosecution or handle this issue in general in collaboration with the criminal justice system. So that's what I want to change.
So how do you, in a way that has not previously been feasible for whatever reason, how do you see a new initiative stepping in with domestic violence before it escalates to homicide? What's new about this?
This is, sadly, I guess I'll say, it's a new effort that's being looked at academically and led in some cities by academics. So one of those cities that we are looking at is High Point. High Point is a city that undertook this kind of initiative and has shown a market reduction in domestic violence-related homicides. Now, that's maybe not a completely comparable city because of population size, but there are others that are undertaking the same kind of effort, like Baton Rouge, as well as another peer city that I look at for a lot of other metrics. They are also trying.
I want to jump in and make sure that we're being really clear about, though, what it is we're talking about. You're talking about essentially identifying domestic violence perpetrators who are most likely to move into this lethally dangerous territory.
Correct.
So explain that.
So that is largely a metric that is driven by law enforcement. Law enforcement is not the only metric, but is the primary one. So it is not uncommon when a case comes into our office for review for charges that we see the number of domestic violence arrests and that we see the number of maybe municipal convictions for domestic assault or related charges. So what we're going to do is gather all of this data to determine who's the worst of the worst, who's most likely, based on their criminal record and their other contacts with the criminal justice system and their victims' contacts with the system, indicate that they are the most lethal.
That seems like such a... I on the one hand, totally appreciate that you see patterns and that failing to recognize those patterns and act on them is just hugely problematic. I also think, like, what a project to try and predict who is going to kill.
Right. The goal is how accurately can we do that? And when we feel that we have built this, those risk factors, and that we know who exhibits those risk factors, can we go about the prosecution of those without relying solely on the back of the victim to get there?
Right, so because right now that's one of the system's failures, as you see it, is what it puts on the person who has been abused.
Right. The victim is so very vulnerable in our system. And, you can be a first-year lawyer and realize that by listening to jail calls and listening to the offender repeatedly call their victim. And sometimes, the tactic is a little bit different. Sometimes it's guilt. Sometimes it's threats about you don't want me prosecuted. And you listen to their jail calls and you can see the level of danger that they are in.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions for Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker. She's here to talk about a new initiative to intervene in domestic violence before it escalates to homicide. 816-235-2888. I do understand that this is part of a national effort. What have been some of the outcomes in other places that have done this?
So one of those cities that we're studying, and I've looked at for some time because we thought about undertaking this effort once before, but it was so early in the early stages. My fear, to be blunt, was that we would violate our do no harm philosophy.
Can you explain that?
You know, undertaking an effort like this and knowing the vulnerability of victims, it still weighs on my shoulders pretty heavily, the do no harm philosophy. We do not wish to cause a victim an ounce more of harm in their life. So that being said, they are already at a really high risk based on the people that we identify, based on these risk factors. So the best thing I can do, I think, is to wade into this territory and make sure I'm trying to find other ways at going about a prosecution so that the victim does not carry the full weight and responsibility as a key witness in those cases. And what I mean by that is that these fellas, generally fellas, although, you know, it's very possible that there could be a female in the mix, they commit a lot of violent acts. So, you know, just harming their intimate partner is just one aspect of their life. So we want to make sure we're looking at their full history and making sure, you know, maybe if I got to go back in time and take a look at some old case, that I'm able to do that and resurrect it so that I can, one, protect this victim, but two, I can do so without relying on her to be the primary bit of testimony that convicts him.
Do I understand correctly that you're saying you can often find something else in someone's past that perhaps puts them behind bars and keeps a victim safe?
That's right. We'll do what it takes to protect these victims. We're going to do what it takes. And when I say do what it takes, we're going to do what it takes legally. But I'm going to use every one of those tools I have at my disposal to do that. And if it means that I can protect a victim by leveraging, you know, the power of the state through a property damage or, you know, making sure that your taxes are paid and paid on time like they were supposed to, we're going to do that. We're going to take a look at you, and we're going to look very thoroughly at those offenders, and we're going to do what we have to do.
So after you've identified the what you call the worst of the worst, part of what you're doing is looking into their records and trying to identify other things that could help you make a case against this person. Is there anything else that goes into this? I understand that monitoring is also a piece of it.
So that, you know, the worst of the worst, right, is the only real philosophy in saving these people's lives is making sure you identify the worst of the worst as effectively as you can, and then finding a mechanism to get them off the street. So, but that's
or out of their homes.
Well, really, to keep victims safe, if you're in this top tier category of folks that we're talking about, the most dangerous, the most violent, we really have to remove them from society. But that's a relatively small group of people. Thank goodness, this is a relatively small group. There are other categories of people that fall below where there is a different measure about how we exact justice for them. And sometimes it's through different types of interventions where they can still be deterred from, you know, reaching that top category. That's important as well, that we're following the metrics as to how to address offenders, depending on their level of violence.
You know, we've talked about what the challenges, or I guess what the successes have been in other cities that you've observed, where you've taken some time to look at other cities that have implemented an intervention process, kind of like the one that you're pursuing in Kansas City. What have been the challenges as you've looked at those cities? Surely it cannot be going perfectly because nothing does. So I guess, what are your concerns going in?
I think, you know, this model is called focused deterrence. We've done it in Kansas City before. And
in what context?
We did it not with intimate partner violence, but we did it to put a focus on group or gang related violence in this city. And it gave us a market reduction in 2014 and in large through about halfway through the year of 2015. And then we slid, and we've slid pretty hard since then. But I do know that focused deterrence can work and that it can be effective, and we can save people's lives if it's done appropriately and effectively. That's what this is. It's focused deterrence, but focusing in on domestic violence abusers instead of a different population. And what is important is that the law enforcement strategy is just one strategy. And that's, as we talked about quite a bit already, and that's the worst of the worst, those top tier offenders. But thank goodness, most people don't fall into that category. The vast majority of people do not, and they can be deterred by other types of touches from the criminal justice system. And one of those touches has to be a new voice. And that new voice is a community-wide voice that says, hey, we know what you're up to. We know what's happening behind closed doors in your home. And we're here to tell you that we don't approve of your behavior.
How does that voice emerge?
It literally emerges through a letter that is sent on behalf of this coalition to the abuser. And we make sure that the victim is not the focus. It is the offender's behavior that is the focus. And this seems so obvious. It seems so very obvious, but it's difficult for all of us. And in fact, it's a little bit difficult, I think, in our collaboration, where we want to know often, well, why does a victim allow herself to be abused? Why does she stay? Why does she keep finding partners like that, that would harm her? And so a whole lot of time and attention in all of our systems are focused on the victim.
I am so curious about this letter. So under what circumstances does a letter get sent, and what does it say?
So sometimes that letter is inviting them to what we call a call-in, and it's an opportunity for us to have a conversation with them and to tell them that we know more about them than they know, than they think we know, at least. And it's our opportunity, give them that new moral voice that we're not really worried and focused on the victim. We are focused on you, offender. And we're focused on, why do you hit? Why do you abuse? Why do you do that? Are there stressors in your life that we can address, that we can help you address? Are there other things that we can do to help alleviate some of those stressors? But this behavior, it's never okay. It's not all right. And all of us collectively, law enforcement, prosecutors, social services, community, are here to tell you it is not okay.
And so the piece of it that's, under what circumstances does this letter get sent? I mean, this is, I am guessing, in situations where you have enough information to feel confident this letter is warranted, but not enough to take legal action against somebody?
We believe these are offenders that will fall into that lower category where deterrence can be an effective model without doing a criminal justice approach. So the social services community will be critical in this role to help us lead that kind of effort, where it is the whole goal with other offenders that don't fall in this top tier is that, can we offer them help and services and a voice that says it's never okay, never, to strike your spouse or your partner. It's never okay. So what can we do to help you do that? And there's some liability for you if we can't figure this out.
Can we get back to the monitoring piece of how you are sussing out who is, quote, the worst of the worst?
So we haven't gotten there yet to figure out how all of this is going to work out together. We have another working group that is planned to meet later this month, and we'll work out some of the details as to who in our collaboration will be best able to carry that monitoring role And so there are pieces to this that we're still trying to figure out for Kansas City, though other cities, like I mentioned, High Point has been able to pull this off and do it quite well. In High Point, it is largely led by their police department, and their police department does a phenomenal job of keeping tabs on these types of offenders and making sure that they are addressing them with the right touch.
I am curious. I mean, it sounds like there almost has to be some period where the perpetrator of abuse is being watched and you're keeping tabs on the situation, trying to know enough about it. I'm trying, for empathy's sake, to put myself in the position of someone who is being abused in my home and also being watched by law enforcement, and just how unsettling it would be in that period before a real intervention occurred. Are there plans in place to support people through that?
Absolutely. Imagine how unsettling it is for a victim to be in that situation, in a setting where the message that she hears is that, you know, it's okay. It's okay that he hits me. There's no consequence for it. Even if he went through the criminal justice system at some lower level, he wasn't really punished for it. He didn't, it didn't deter his behavior at all. So the message that she often hears is, it doesn't matter. People don't care, or this is okay. And what we want offenders to know, it's not okay. And we want victims to know that as well. But we want victims to know our focus is on why he hits instead of why does she stay. There's a lot of reasons why a woman may choose to stay in a relationship where she's being harmed. Some of that is for her own safety. I know that maybe makes no sense.
Choose might not entirely be the word.
Choose is probably the wrong word. But she's making a series of decisions in where she has a series
calculated.
Of bad decisions to make, right? There aren't good ones in there. And we also know, statistically, we know that the most dangerous time for women is when they leave. When they leave. That's statistically true. And though I know that because I've read that statistic numerous times, they know it because they live it and they've been threatened. They know what's going to happen to them when they leave, when they're real serious and they go.
When you talk about building a legal case really proactively against someone based not necessarily on the instance of abuse, but on something else in their record, I guess thinking about what I understand to be the case, that abuse occurs and domestic violence occurs at all socioeconomic levels, it seems like someone with means might be able to otherwise keep their nose clean in a different way. You know what I'm saying? Like when you're talking about unpaid taxes or something like that. Granted, tax evasion occurs at all socioeconomic levels too. But I'm
yes,
just wondering, is it harder to build that case against someone with means?
I don't believe so. The reason I think that is not the case is because these individuals tend to show themselves in a variety of ways. They are abusers in all parts of their life. If you're going to fall into this top category of offender, you are an offender that you show yourself in a variety of other circumstances. So it's not usually surprising.
Jean Peters Baker, Jackson County Prosecutor, thanks so much for stopping by.
You are welcome. Pleased to be here.
We will be following up on this initiative as it unfolds, bringing other voices and perspectives into the studio for future conversations. But it has been interesting to hear the idea behind this. Next on KCUR Central Standard, the host of a new PBS show, Your Inner Fish, is in town to talk to scientists. In just a minute, you'll get your chance to hear from him, too. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Neil Shubin is the host of a new show on PBS. It's called Your Inner Fish, a journey into the 3.5 billion year history of the human body. As a scientist, Neil sees people a little differently. The show opens in a crowded subway car where we get to look at all these human bodies doing human body things through Neil's eyes, starting with a hand reaching out to grab a pole for balance.
The way we grip with our hands, we can thank our primate ancestors for that. How we hear so many sounds, that dates back to creatures the size of a shrew. And the further back we go, the stranger it gets.
What he's alluding to there, the further back we go, the stranger it gets, is the big discovery of his career, fossils that bridge the gap between animals that swim in the water and animals that walk on land or, you know, ride subways like we do. Neil Shubin, host of Your Inner Fish, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are here to talk to fellow scientists at Stowers. Is it unusual for you at this point to be talking to an audience of fellow scientists as opposed to the TV-watching public?
Well, here in Kansas City, I'm actually privileged to do both. Today, I'm giving a talk to the general public, and tomorrow to the scientists at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research. Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, it's, speaking to different crowds, speaking to different audiences, it really changes how you look at your own science.
Tell me about the big discovery of yours, which forms the basis of first a book and now a PBS show kind of based on that book.
So my colleagues and I, working in the Canadian Arctic, from 1998 to 2004, were really looking at rocks about 375 million years old. And the reason why we were doing that is to try to find a creature that's right at the cusp of creatures that live in water and live on land. And rocks of that age were sort of perfect for that. We discovered a creature about 4 feet long. If I was to hold it in front of you, what you'd see, it has scales on its back and fins with fin webbing. And that looks like, you know, sort of any fish. But if you look closer, you'd see it has a head like a land living animal, like a crocodile. And if you look inside that fin, guess what you see? Arm bones, upper arm, forearm, even parts of a wrist inside a fish. This creature had lungs and gills. It was right at the cusp of creatures just beginning to walk on land.
Take me back to, first of all, not just the moment of discovery, but the question you were asking that put you in the position to find these fossils in the first place.
The question that I was asking actually began when I was a student trying to think about what I was going to do research on for my career. And the professor showed a slide showing a fish on top and a land living animal on the bottom. And the slide said, you know, sometime about 375 million years ago, fish evolved to walk on land. That seems so utterly crazy to me. You know, everything has to change. So my...
Because I think about when I hear that sentence, I think about a tadpole, you know, and then becoming a frog. I can imagine that's already a pretty weird life story, but I can imagine that in the life of a creature. But that's basically when you see those diagrams of evolution and it shows like creature, one creature to the next and how it varies slightly. Is it basically like as life, we're kind of like the tadpole that got up and hopped?
Well, something like that. Think about it this way. For billions of years, all life was in the water. It was fish, it was bacteria, it was worm-like creatures. Then at some point, creatures started to live on land. It was a very different planet. And so my quest became to find creatures that tell us how that happened. How did fish with fins evolve to walk on land? And so we set out to find a fossil that's just perfectly intermediate between the two ways of living. And that's what led us to the Arctic.
And so the difference isn't just how you move. It is also, for example, how you breathe, like a lot of different stuff.
Oh, yeah. How you breathe, how you feed, you know, how you move about. Everything has to change. And so the question is, how can we gain access to understanding that? And it turns out that the science is at a remarkable moment because we can make predictions about where in the world, where are places that are likely to hold those fossils. It's truly amazing. And that's what my colleagues and I did, and that's what other colleagues from around the world are doing right now as well.
When you and your colleagues did this, what year are we talking about?
We had the idea to do this in 1998. It was an aspiration for about a decade before that. And so we started our first trip and looked for these things and didn't find anything our first year. Found a little bit more the second year. A little bit more, but we're still kind of not doing it in the third year. It took us four seasons over 6 years to find what we were looking for, really sticking to it.
So what can you take me with you to a moment like this? Because most of us we have exciting moments, but like the moment where you lay eyes on something you've been searching for that solves a big question about life as we know it, the little rock that tells you that. Most of us don't get that.
You know, there are moments where science is truly thrilling. It really can be. You know, imagine, you know, my colleagues and I were working for, you know, for all this time, not looking for something and not finding it. Then one day, we're in a layer of rock, cracking those rocks, and one of my colleagues says, "Hey, guys, what's this?" And we knew there were bones in the rock. We were pulling them out, but this was different. This was the head of a fish, but it was a flat-headed fish, like a crocodile. I knew as soon as I saw that we were on the right path.
Why did you know? What about a flat-headed fish told you that? Because I would see a flat-headed fish and be like, that looks weird.
Yeah, so I mean, it turns out that the earliest limbed animals, the earliest creatures to walk on land, had flat heads. And not only flat heads of a certain style with certain kinds of bones inside it. And so when I first saw that snout...
When you say flat, you mean like...
Like a crocodile.
Okay.
Imagine like a crocodile.
Flat on top. Okay.
Flat head with eyes on top, that kind of thing. And I literally had the rocks looking at me, one of those flat-headed things. And it, you know, but it had fish bones. I'm like, wait, here's a thing that had fish bones, but had a head like an early land animal. I knew we had found what we were looking for. So it was just a remarkable moment of, you know, confirming that, you know, science is in so many ways a life of discovery. And this was just a moment where it all came to be, you know, and it was.
Do you remember what
thing.
You said? Did you like jump and scream?
Yeah, I jumped up and down, and we're all jumping up and down and things like that. And all of a sudden we realized we had a big problem. We're in the Arctic, okay, and the weather was turning pretty bad, and we only had a limited time to be in the field. You only have a short time. We were up about 600 miles from the North Pole. And, you know, it was just one of these things where our jubilation turned to, okay, let's get this out of the rock now. We got to go. So we became very serious after some jumping up and down.
So when you talk about our inner fish, does that mean something to – because that's the title of your book. It's also the title of your show. And I wonder if the concept of an inner fish means something to you philosophically, like as one of these humans with an inner fish, does it mean something to you beyond just that there is a fish ancestor back there somewhere?
It means way more. That's just the tip of the iceberg, as they say. I mean, if you look at our bodies, inside every organ, inside every tissue, inside every cell, inside every piece of DNA of our bodies, we have artifacts of 4 billion years of the history of life. That is the incredible thing. And so when you know how to look, first you see the history we share with other primates. Then you see the history we share with other mammals. Then you see the history we share with reptiles. It's like peeling an onion and looking at ever deeper. And what's remarkable about the story is that we know this through discovery. We know this from people finding fossils like the one we found, but others as well. We know this from people studying DNA and looking at genes and how we're related to other organisms. And it's such a beautiful thing that we are related to the rest of life on the planet. And your inner fish is just sort of a metaphor for that, just one stopping point. I could have called it your inner worm, your inner monkey, you know, your inner reptile. Fish just stood out because that's what we were working on.
When you found this fossil of a flat-headed land creature with fish bones, am I characterizing that correctly?
You got it, yeah.
So you find this. Did you name it? Did you name the creature?
Yeah, so we were working there really with the indigenous people in the Canadian Arctic, with the Inuit population. We had Inuit youth with us. There was an Inuit village about 200 miles away. They were part of it. We were there at their pleasure. So we had a naming project with the Inuit community, and the elders came up with the name Tiktaalik, and that stuck as the scientific name.
So that's the scientific name. Do you have and that's also a familiar name in some way?
Yeah, it's a familiar name for them. It's a large freshwater fish that they're used to hunting, which lives in some of the streams. And it's sort of the head sort of reminded them of a fish that they would hunt in the western part of the Arctic. But, you know, it's also called a fishapod, you know, that kind of thing. Fish with feet, that kind of deal.
I want to read a line from your faculty bio at the University of Chicago. You say that your work is based on, and I quote, "the conviction that progress in the study of evolutionary biology results from linking research across diverse temporal, phylogenetic, and structural scales." What does that mean? Because I like the idea that you have a deep conviction at the basis of your work, but I don't actually understand what it is.
Well, that's a mouthful, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a mouthful
that conveys a point that's really kind of fundamental to science. And that is that breakthroughs in understanding any question, any great problem in science, really come from pulling together as many perspectives, as many tools as you possibly can. And so in my case, understanding this great transition from life in water to life on land, or our own evolutionary history as a species comes down to finding fossils, comes down to understanding how creatures are built from the egg to adult, how they develop as embryos, comes down from understanding DNA and how DNA works and builds bodies. So really, you know, we're like detectives trying to marshal as many lines of evidence pointing to the same story as possible. Well, that's kind of what we are as scientists: evidence from fossils, evidence from embryos, evidence from DNA. That's really kind of what that quote was about. And it, to me, it reflects one of the great sort of dynamic things about a life in science, that you're always learning new tools, always trying to, discover new things. And that's just been, really fabulous.
When you talk about DNA, we haven't really explored how DNA factored into the story that you were trying to tell, and that the fossil that you found helped you tell. How does DNA help you tell that story?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. So we can study human DNA. We can study mouse DNA. We can study, the DNA of creatures that are alive today. And we can ask the question, what is the DNA that builds hands and feet? Okay, what's the DNA that builds our toes and fingers and wrists and ankles? And science has gotten very good at identifying the major candidate, the genes that are active when that happens in the embryo, right? Then we can ask the question, is that DNA in fish? And the answer is yes. And the question is that DNA that builds our fingers and toes, is it active in fish during their development? The answer is yes to that as well. Is it active during the formation of the fins? Yes, it is. And guess what? It's making the terminal ends of fins. So the genes...
Wait, my fingers are fin-like?
Many of the genes
especially
that build
if I wiggle
your fingers
them?
Are present in fish, building their fins. And I can say that for almost every organ. And some of them are active in flies. In fact, most of them were identified by work on flies. So it's remarkable that understanding our own bodies requires knowing other creatures.
Because but I don't really relate to fish in that way. Like, I know that's a weird thing to say, but like when I look at a fish, I don't feel that we have a lot in common.
Well, look at your hands and bend your wrist back and forth. Look at your neck and move your head back and forth. The first time we see a neck in the fossil record, the first time we see a wrist in the fossil record is in fish living in aquatic ecosystems. And I can trace those bones all the way from fish to amphibians to reptiles to mammals to primates to people, and we see that story.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking with scientist Neil Shubin on faculty at the University of Chicago, host of Your Inner Fish on PBS. He is in town for a talk tonight at Stowers, 6:30 p.m. And this is your chance to ask a question if you can't make it. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Neil Shubin, host of Your Inner Fish on PBS, and he's blowing my mind with the observation of how fish-like I am. Hi again, Neil.
Hello.
So you focus a lot on limbs. Can you talk about the significance of limbs?
Yeah, think about so much we're capable of as a species. So much of what we do as humans is not only having thoughts and memories and feelings and perceptions and plans for the future, but it's also making those things real. And how do we do that? Well, we do it with words by which we communicate with one another, but we also do it with our hands that can make things, that can change the world. So literally, the hand, the human hand, is an organ that has changed the planet. In many ways, some for the better, some for the worse, but we've changed the planet. And I find it so utterly fascinating and interesting that organ, which is so quintessentially human, can be traced all the way to fish, and the genes that build it even deeper still.
And that is the beginning, as far as you're concerned, of limbs is fish?
Yes. And indeed, the genes that make it, the DNA that makes limbs, actually was present well before then doing other things. Yeah, it's a remarkable story.
So if you had called it your inner worm, the limbs thing would have
Yeah, it might have been, so I would have focused on the segmentation of the body, how we're built like that way. I could have stopped at any point. I could have called this your inner fly, your inner worm.
What would the inner fly have been about?
Yeah, the inner fly would have been about, what's really amazing. Just look at Nobel Prizes. People have won Nobel Prizes in medicine and physiology that, for breakthroughs about human health. understanding genes and cellular processes in flies. And the only reason that that's possible is because we're related to flies, and that an understanding of the biology of fruit flies and other creatures like that has really helped us understand our own biology, our own bodies. That's leveraging those connections we share with other species. It's an amazing thing.
Okay, so you have helped me see my hands as fins, which is still kind of weirding me out. But when we think about the transition from fish to land creature, it seems like the leg and foot are, that would also be like a pretty big one.
Yeah, this creature has legs as well. I mean, has leg bones in this fish we found as well. So it seems to be evolving in lockstep, if you will, our arms and legs, the front fins and the back fins. And, you know, we were really lucky. We found about 20 skeletons of these creatures. It's not rare. We found a whole bunch in the years since. And, you know, each one is telling us about, you know, the anatomy of what, you know, our distant relative looked like 375 million years ago. You know, what a privilege that is, you know, to be able to explore and see what the world and what species looked like way in the distant past. And it's amazing that, you know, we as scientists can make predictions, you know, about likely places to find these things. You know, we didn't just stumble on it. We had worked for 6 years planning expeditions to find just that.
The story of evolution as we tell it tends to land and kind of end with us as though we're like the culmination of it all. But in theory, it's still going.
Ah, yeah. I mean, we're just pikers. I mean, you know, we're just one species. It's the microbes that rule the world, the little bacteria and viruses and so forth that are evolving as we speak. And, you know, their evolution is affecting us greatly. We rely on them. And we not only rely on them, our health is in a balance with the microbes that are around us, and they are evolving. If you look at our genome and the human genome from around the world, it turns out we're still evolving. Other species are evolving. Evolution doesn't stop. It's, you know, we live in a world of change. Our genes are changing just like the genes of the creatures that are around us.
So when you talk about being able to predict where things are going, do you have predictions about like when you look at the human, we have these ancestors that had fins. Do we have progeny down the road that have something else that you're thinking about?
Well, if you think about us as a species, we... you know, we can really affect our own biology by the ideas we have as a species. We're a little different now. You know, with our technologies, our medicines, they affect how we function, how we evolve. And so, you know, I'd like to think, like, if you and I and our listeners were to take a time machine, right, and come back in, say, 10,000 years and get out of our time machine and look around and ask, you know, what are people doing? How long are they living? How smart are they? How are they functioning in their world? How long do they live? You know, it may not be sort of the classic sort of genetic Darwinian evolution that's leading to these capabilities, and it's our technologies probably, and access to those technologies. So we're sort of as a species at a sort of an important moment where technology really impacts our biology so dramatically, you know?
You know, I will sometimes joke now that if I have an idea, I have to kind of make a note of it on my phone, because that is now the extension of my brain, like where I kind of keep my thoughts.
Yeah.
Is there, I mean, on some level, when you talk about technology as part of how we're evolving, do you see technology as being sort of integral to human life at this point on that level?
Oh, most definitely. Just take it at the most simple level. I'm wearing glasses right now. You know, there is no way I would have survived in an African savanna plain 3.5 million years ago with my eyesight. Okay, so I'm only here because, you know, optical technology has changed how I see. And that's sort of a trivial example. There are so many other medications, technologies. I have a colleague at the University of Chicago who designs chips that can be inserted in human quadriplegic patients' brains, where they can control limbs and robots and things like that just by thoughts alone. You know, so you talk about our phones, our smartphones as being sort of extensions of our brains, and they literally are. It's like a third frontal lobe in some ways. But we're actually doing that in technology now with implants. And so technology is a human capability that can affect how we interact with each other, the planet, and how our bodies function.
I mean, you mentioned something controlling like helping a quadriplegic control their limbs. I also think about if you look around at like a park, when you learn science like high school biology, you classify different species or at least that's what you're taught, is that it's part, like, what kind of ambulatory creature is this? Like, is this bipedal or on 4 feet, or is this a slithering creature or what? But if you look at just the range of human beings and how we move, it's like, is this a wheeled creature? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, there are many ways to get around, right? And so, you know, and if you look at our style of walking, has deep roots in the history of life. The bones we used to walk with were actually first seen in fish, but the nerves that control all that stuff, that control how we walk and the gait that we have, all those patterns actually go very much deeper in time if you look at other creatures.
This idea that we have fish for ancestors, I mean, there is a part of our population that does really struggle with the idea of primate ancestors. How do people respond when you talk about fish ancestors? Do you get pushback on that kind of philosophical level?
I try not to insult people's beliefs and so forth, but I can't help myself by being inspired by science. I can't help myself by being inspired by discovery and by the process that led us to the Canadian Arctic, of all places, near the North Pole, to find a fish that has arm bones inside its fins, lungs inside its body. So I think the story, the more we can get to the stories of discovery about how we as scientists know things and the human element that's involved in struggling to find that, in failing for 5 years until finding it on the sixth, until, you know, the decisions that go into these things, I think the more we focus on that as science as a human enterprise, I think the less it can get into that other space.
When you think about questions that you still would like to answer and places you might like to go to search for answers, what's on your mind right now?
I like to focus ever deeper in time into deeper questions. Where did this fish we found, what are its closest relatives? Where did fish themselves come from? Well, we kind of know that they came from worm-like animals, but what are the details to that? So that hunt has led me to Antarctica most recently. I was there from November through January of this year. You know, a life in science is a life of never-ending questions, right? Just when you answer one, there's 30 others show up. And so as we develop new technologies and new approaches, the kinds of questions that we can ask change themselves. So it's never-ending.
And when you talk about your recent trip to try and understand where the fish came from, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I went to Antarctica in November. Led a team of six people living in the ice. Oh, imagine this. Where we work in Antarctica is on the ice, right? You have the ice platform, and it's about at 7,000 feet. But we're working in a place called the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. These are mountain ranges that actually poke through the ice. So you stand on the ice and you see these mountains, the tips of them are poking through. And the rocks that are on those mountains, guess what? They are 385 million years old, a little bit older than the Arctic, and they reflect ancient tropical rainforests back in history. So imagine that. Here I am in the ice of Antarctica, this frozen wasteland today, minus 20 degrees standard temperature, minus 40 wind chills.
Can I stop imagining now?
Yeah, that's right. Ah, it's gorgeous though. And but you know, inside the rocks is a whole different world. Inside the rocks is a tropical rainforest, you know, with fish and plants and shrubs. You know, to that juxtaposition between present and past is an amazing thing, and that's what led us there.
Did you see anything that you thought might hold answers, or is it going to be another next year and the year after?
I'm afraid that's my life. It's going to be next year and the year after. We found a ton of fossil bones, and we found so many that it's hard for us to identify. We found a fish graveyard where one bone is piled on top of the other. So our hunt right now is going to be back in the laboratory where we image these bones and try to see what skeletons are inside the graveyard.
When you talk about imaging, like, how do you do that?
Nowadays, we use these high-energy CT scanners. They're not one you'd want to go inside because they're so high energy, but we can blast through the rock and look at the bones inside the rocks.
Not physically blast through, but blast through
with X-rays.
With imaging.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Neil Shubin, thank you so much for stopping by today and joining us. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you.
It's my pleasure.
Neil is a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. He's the author of Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. And he's host of a PBS series by the same name. He's in town to give a talk at the Stowers Institute tonight at 6:30. That's a wrap for today's show on Central Standard. You can grab this conversation or the one we had earlier in the hour at kcur.org/centralstandard. That was a talk with the Jackson County prosecutor. We discussed a new initiative to prevent homicide by intervening more rigorously in domestic violence situations before they escalate to that point. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, controversy over a recent story on pain treatment shows how intimate pain is and how deep held our convictions about it are. We'll hear different takes on pain, what it means, and how to treat it tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.